Do it now. He said, money and truth have nothing to do with one another. He said, when you didn't know it was a lie, it was all right. Once you know it's a lie and you keep doing it, then the karma is on you. Do it now. And he threw me out of the temple. He says, go do it now. So I left the temple and I thought, oh my God, I mean, all of our commune isn't worth $10,000 practically. And I'm telling, and we're broke, and I'm going to send them a telegram saying, throw out this $30,000, don't sell them, and print another one. Okay, I mean, the guru tests you, here we go. So I went back up and I sent a cable saying, you know, do not pass go, do not collect 200, throw out that, start again, do the, another 30,000. These are orders, and I will cover it later. I'll earn the money and pay you back. Don't worry, go ahead and do it, because I'm telling you to do it. Because it's Maharaji's book, and he wants it done that way. Now, I get a letter back from Stephen Durkee saying, I got your cable. Strangest thing happened. I got your cable just as a letter arrived from the printer. He had put the job on the press, and when he was putting it on the press, he found that one of the plates for the book was missing. And he went into the file where he had all the originals, and the page for that plate was also missing, which was a picture of Maharaji. And since he didn't know what to do, he pulled the job off the press and was waiting for further instructions. So the entire change cost them the cost of a telephone call. Right? Now, who? And if you allow the possibility that perhaps, is Reagan or who is? I mean, where is the game played from? Is there some guy up in a cave up in the Himalayas sort of flaked out, you know, now and then creating a universe in which we are all busy huffing and puffing? I mean, I don't really know. I'm certainly willing to allow the possibility because I certainly don't think that Reagan is a cause. I think he's an effect. I think he thinks he's a cause. But I sure as hell don't experience him that way. I see him as a reactive being with very little consciousness. Not a bad guy. I mean, he doesn't have evil intent. He's just a reactive being. And the media are reactive to him, and he's reactive to them, and they're reactive to them. And so that's why it is the collective consciousness that he represents. That's why he gets elected. That's why the media makes such a big deal out of him, because he represents a lot of stuff that we are. And when we aren't, he won't be either. Wow. Interesting. Yes.
To save myself from misquoting you from a tape I heard yesterday, what I heard you say was the best or all that we can really give to someone else is our own truth. And you said some people, I heard you say, some people aren't ready to hear our truth. And you said you make some sort of differentiation between those who are ready and those who aren't. And probably the similar things that happened down there, but I'd like to hear more about that.
You examine, you sense what the nature of the license is, what the nature of the contract is with another human being. And there's a difference between putting truth into the words and being truth. And sometimes people aren't asking you. Like, I work with people that have terminal illnesses or illnesses that will most likely be terminal. There are many people that have cancer and that don't want to know they have cancer. Now, when I walk into a room and I've just been with the doctor and the doctor's told me, and I walk into the room and that person doesn't ask, it is not my job to tell them they have cancer. I will be environment that will be so available and present that if they say, do I have cancer, I will say yes. But I won't go and say, you know you have cancer. Because I don't really have a moral right to force another person to face the truth unless they ask me to help them face the truth. Forcing somebody to awaken when they don't want to awaken. All I think I can do is be an environment for another person where if they want to awaken, I am available. And in human relations, it's interesting because a lot of contracts that seem to be based on truth really aren't. They are based on a conspiracy of you don't shake my ego and I won't shake yours. And they're not really asking for that truth. And what the option to forcing truth is silence. It's not lying, but it's silence. Am I dealing with your question? Are you upset? You want to pursue it? You want something else said? Are you hearing it?
I'd like to hear more about that later. You're also giving the analogy of people walking around with nets. You said it was some comic strip you saw.
Yeah.
And on their forehead, it's like, I'll screw you over for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And yes, saying, this is who I am, this is who I am, this is who I am.
That's where I'm stuck.
Now, you meet somebody that is busy being somebody, okay? Somebody comes down the street and is busy projecting out their somebodyness. Your consciousness is to allow them to hold on to their somebodyness if they choose. But if they are ready to let go of it, there's nothing in you that's going to keep them from doing it. It's where your mind is. If I see that bank teller as only a bank teller, and that bank teller then wants to be somebody that says, say, could you help me with this spiritual... what do you mean? You're a bank teller, you know? I mean, if my mind doesn't allow them to be something else, then I am trapping them in their head models. If, on the other hand, somebody comes down because they are also who they think they are, but that's only part of it. All I'm doing is creating an environment where I'm ready. If you want to be only who you think you are, fine. But if you would like to come up for air, I'm out in the street bouncing the ball saying, if you want to come out and play, I'm here. And people are pressing their nose against the window saying, I'd like to, but I can't, really can't. My mother won't let me. It's too close to dinner or whatever it is, you know. And I'm just saying, okay, it's all right. Stay in if you want to, but I'm out here. And it's much more that kind of quality of human relationships rather than you must wake up. I was with a fellow last night who has had some intense spiritual awakenings. And he's very locked into an intense energy about these things. And he feels he's got to tell everybody. Therein lies trouble. You know, why don't you awaken? I mean, that's like kill for Christ. You know, I mean, it's that scary thing of that really... you'll do violence to the universe in order to bring truth. And you can do that if you are a Christ. He says, I come with a sword. And he turns over the tables in the temple. You can do that if you're fully conscious. Then you're free to play any way you want. But until then, you've got to be very conscious of what you're doing. Because you may be doing it out of your own unconsciousness. And you're creating more suffering. You're forcing people to awaken they're not ready to awaken. Yes?
I'm a little unclear about taking on karma.
Taking on karma?
Yeah. For example, maybe if you see somebody that you can maybe help get clear.
The karma is taken on if you do your acts out of attachment. I mean, if you are a healer, say, that lays on hands, if you are attached to taking that stuff from the person, rather than merely being an instrument that you offer, and if they are to be healed, they will be healed, and if they are not, they're not. But if you think you are healing them, and you are taking it, you'll get it. You want it. But the game is to make yourself just like a sieve and pass stuff through just like Chinese food. You know, eat it and a moment later you're hungry. I mean, it's that kind of thing. It just keeps pouring through you all the time because you're not collecting it. You're not collecting it. But if you are looking, when you're doing therapy or healing or something, and you're looking for somebody to say, oh, you really helped me, you got it. There's your karma. You're collecting it. You're attached to the fruits of your actions. There are two rules. Identification with being the actor and attachment to the fruits of the action. If you break both of those, there's no karma. All right? You don't collect karma from anybody. Those are the two things that come out of the Bhagavad Gita. If you are not attached to the fruits of the action, and you are not identified with being the actor. Like if you're doing therapy, you're just here, and therapy is happening, in which it's happening, and whatever's happening is happening, and you're here. And whatever will happen out of it will happen out of it. That one, those two, breaking those two links, then there's no karma in the actions.
But my question gets back to this one over here. Also, quoting from that video yesterday, you said that the important thing is not to tell everyone everything, but to be able to tell everyone everything. There's a lot of cases where the person isn't going to come out and ask you, do I have cancer? They don't know what the question is. You may feel you have a truth to express, but and they may be ready to hear it, but they might not ask. I have trouble often distinguishing between thinking the person's not ready and thinking I am versus not being ready myself.
I hear it. Well, I'll tell you, let me work on it. Let me go and see where the answer lies. The relation between people is on many levels simultaneously. And on one level, it's what they think they want to know and what you think you have to tell them and what licenses they've given you verbally and what they haven't. But there are other levels of relationship that are very much deep, that are intuitive, in which everybody knows what the game is. We don't trust these most of the time. So we go back into what we think they think and what we think we should do, which is the level of the question we're talking about here. And I am inclined to trust that deeper level of communication that's going on between people. And I know that if I walk into a room and there is a certain space that I am in, it creates an environment where if that is something bothering the person, it will surface. And if it is not bothering them, it won't. It'll find its way into form if it is bothering them. I just feel, now sometimes, let me think about it, because sometimes, I'll not think about it, sometimes, I will say to a person, we can keep the relationship at this level, or we can go towards some deeper truth, if you choose. But even that is kind of pushing. What I do, for example, like I do retreats. I'm going to be doing workshops at Omega in New York State and Brighton Bush in Oregon and Lama in New Mexico. There's maybe a couple of hundred people. And sometimes when I get up the courage, I see people individually, which is a lot when you get 250. Well, what I'll do, I just did one in Devon, England, and I said to the group, I'll do individual interviews. They'll be about 6 or 8 minutes long, which a lot can happen in that time if it's used efficiently. But I say, I'll give you 3 choices, and you walk in. Just say, I want A, B, or C. A is you come in, and we will focus on each other's place between the eye, and we will meditate silently together for the 6 or 8 minutes. The B is that you can use me to get to clear out stuff in you and get to a deeper trust and openness with another human being. And if you choose B, I will ask you the question, which I mean, many of you have played this game in one form or another, if there is anything you can bring to mind that would be difficult, embarrassing, or uncomfortable to share with another human being, share it. That's like, don't think of rhinoceros. I mean, it immediately forces the most nitty-gritty stuff to the surface. It's called the cleaner of filth in American Indian tradition. And the third one is we can hang out. Now, by setting up those 3 alternatives, I'm not forcing the second one. The second one is the one that will be the fiercest one, in which we will come most quickly into, here we are, oh my God, I'm not going to tell them that. And then you tell them, and suddenly you break through, and there's this light, and you all know what that's like. I mean, it's like primal zap. You know? But I'm not going to lay it on them. I'm going to give them that option, and that's the most gentle way. All I did was suggested that possibility existed, but I didn't do it, didn't force the hand. And that's the way I play. I mean, I don't know how else to answer your question. I think it's a I am inclined not to force people to, if I sense, now I'm trusting my intuition, sometimes I sense that they have given me the license. I don't demand that they say, here's the written contract, notarized. Or that they say, I give you license. I will sense where that license is. And so you may sense, as long, but you've got to trust whether you're wanting to sense it or you're sensing it. And that's where your attachment to whether you share the truth or not is what the issue is. Because the truth waits, as the Tao says, the truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. If you're longing for that person to know the truth, you'll never know whether there is a contract to tell the truth or not. When you have worked on yourself so that you merely allow the universe to be in which the truth may happen and it may not, and you're listening, you will hear whether or not the contract allows telling the truth. Am I dealing with your question? Okay. Yes.
I hold the idea that I want to live my life.
Excuse me, you got to start again.
I hold the idea that I want to live my life in alignment with the will of God.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if, well, you could speak on that, and also if the idea of affirmations and prosperity and all of the kind of creative things that we do, if that's in alignment. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's a lot of talk these days of like creating prosperity and, you know, envisioning what you want so you can have it. And I'm wondering if that's in alignment with the will of God or if we should just open, you know, to what it is.
I think that as you evolve, more and more you find yourself in the stance of listening. Listening to hear the way of things, which you could call the will of God or the Tao or the evolving form of things or some way in which the next action comes out of your unique capacities and the options and the possibilities and the plan of things. And you're listening to hear the plan, to tune the plan, which is not a rational intellectual plan. It's a deep intuitive plan. And you can't be afraid to make mistakes and go off field and just got to get up. And the minute you feel you're offline, you just get up and keep correcting and correcting and correcting and brush yourself off and get on with it. And then just keep, because it's the whole course of life is like falling on your face, getting up, taking a step, falling on your face, getting up, taking a step, falling on your face. Because you're constantly going to feel the way it is at the moment. And then your mind will think where you think you're going with that, and then you're back in your thoughts again, and then it takes you off. It takes you a little oblique because you're already projecting into the universe rather than listening. You go from listening to projecting to listening to projecting until pretty soon the actions coming out of listening without that intervening thing of models and projections of mind. All right, is that now? There are times when you can hear how things are and you see that they could all be different and there are all kinds of possibilities and there's no reason why you can't all open to things being different than they are. You can work to be economically successful through right livelihood and do very well without being attached to whether or not you do well or not. That's quite a delicate art form. And that's the one right there. It's the attachment to the outcome that's where you're going to trip up. If you are busy being miserable because you don't have the money, it's already got you. I don't have the money, that is the way it is. Also, I could get the money, that is the way it is. I'll work to get the money. If I get the money, I'll get the money. If I don't get the money, I'm still here. That's different. See, there are ways of using it without, it's not using your powers in opposition to the way of things. You are allowing, like, I'm very good at speaking, obviously. You can see, you are sitting here. You know, I mean, and I'm using a power now. But I'm really very, very much attached to it. And I'm doing it, and what happens then, if you didn't sit here, I wouldn't be speaking. And that's the way of it. Then I'd be selling shoes or whatever else I'd be doing. I mean, I don't feel it's a mission or a myth or anything. I'm just listening. If this is the way of things, this will be the way of things. Tomorrow I find I have AIDS or cancer or something. Okay, that's a new thing to deal with. Ah, so. Ah, so. Ah, so. Ah, so. So. It doesn't mean in any way you can't use your mind and your will to change things, to bring about peace, to bring about prosperity, to bring about happiness, to bring about good health, to bring about all these things. But your attachment to whether or not those things happen is where the trap is. Saying, if you don't do it, God, screw you. Or it's the issue of Job. It's really Job's relation to God that we're rethinking now at this moment. Yes.
On the tape yesterday, you described relationships as two people becoming one awareness and then going back into two individual entities. Would you expand on that explanation, please?
If you and I come together and meet as separate entities, and then as I was talking about in the karma yoga thing, we start to go closer, and I see that you are woman and I am man. You are also Western and I am Western. You are also perhaps cook and I am eater. You are also, I have a car and you're a rider. I mean, we can go through role after role after role. After a while, after we've met in dozens and dozens of role relationships, we start to realize that in us which is common to all of them or behind them. And it is a place in which both of us are aware of our different roles with each other. I'm the one that does the salad, and you're the one that does the, you know, the main course. I'm the one that changes the diapers, and you're the, it's all on like that. And we start to meet in a space where there is one awareness, but there's two bodies moving in and out of different roles. And that shared awareness keeps, if you keep cultivating it, it becomes a recognized third component in the relationship. And it happens in people that have been together for years. They begin to say, I know what you're thinking all the time. I mean, you get to know another person so well. But if you start to see it as a triangle, you see you're cultivating a place where we are both seeing the universe roughly from the same place. It's not a space or time locus, because in space or time, you're separate from me. But in our awarenesses, there's a place where our awarenesses are not separate. And that's the place we have to cultivate and acknowledge. That's the thing about that big part of us that doesn't have any form, because that's not in form. There's no place where we are one. There is a non-place where we are one, but not a place where we are one. And as we acknowledge the non-place, that starts to get richer and richer and more real and solid in our awareness. And then we start to go out into the two, and we start to play with the two from the one. And then we are at play in the two. Like I work with staffs, we just went through a board meeting in which there is a tremendous shared awareness of our, we have these kind of confrontational first few days of the board meeting where we clean out all the crap that's between us and the lack of truths and the all that stuff. And once it's there, there's a shared awareness we share, and then we all play our different parts in the dance. And we're delighting in the one of us being the many-handed hydra, you know, that's doing all this stuff. Some of us are in Nepal, some in India, some in here and there, and we're all doing different things. But there's a shared awareness, values, consciousness that's rooting it. And you got to cultivate that constantly. Is that dealing with the question? Yes.
In one of the tapes yesterday, you mentioned something about somebody that was close to you that was suffering a kind of illness. And you said something or a way of that person, how that person deal with the illness. You know, I couldn't get it very much. That person, I think, was your father.
In what? Shingles.
How did he deal with the illness?
Well, if the other person is busy being ill, the first thing is you, if they are suffering, you do what you can to relieve the suffering. I mean, I called around and I found out what all the possible cures were for it, And I found out that Laura Huxley had the same thing, and I called her and asked her what treatment she used, and I got the different medicines, and we tried this and tried that. I mean, you do that at that level. The other part is that you cultivate in yourself this quietness of mind that says, this is all the stuff of life, and this is the way this is at this moment. So you allow the illness to be. At the same moment, you're doing the best you can to get rid of it because the person wants to get rid of it, but you are not busy being caught in, I've got to get rid of this illness. It's the same thing I'm talking about, the same thing about attachment to the end of it. So that you are helping the person, but yet allowing whatever happens to happen. I don't know whether he's supposed to have shingles, because maybe the shingles force awakening in him. How presumptuous of me to think that he is not supposed to have shingles. If he doesn't want shingles, I'll do my best to help get rid of them. But whether they go or not, that is not in my hands. All right? And that's the one about the attachment to, you love other people and you don't want them to suffer. And that's an interesting one, because in a way that's a little presumptuous. You got to watch that. It's a very delicate one about the attachment to loved ones. And it's not something you should get uptight about. It's our human condition. But you just stay open to it. Sorry, I'm not answering that fully, but I don't really think I can get hold of it better than that tonight. The other question. Yes?
If a nuclear holocaust did occur, and this planet would no longer support human life, what happens to all the karma? Or, in other words, how necessary is the human form to do the work?
I feel that as long as there is need for some plane of existence, because there are beings who need that plane, they create it. I mean, I think this plane is the collective creation of the attachments of the entities that make it real, which includes animals and plants and humans and all of it. And that if those consciousnesses didn't project it in, outward, it wouldn't be. And as long as those consciousnesses need it, it will be. It will be here and there. I mean, I don't question that we create just exactly what we need to get on with what we're doing, which is in a spiritual evolutionary sense. So to think that this is the only place this earth can be, or consciousness can exist, or forms can take this particular type of density and work with these particular kinds of desires, I don't know that to be the case. I mean, we don't know. We keep asking, is there life on other galaxies or whatever? We may get a chance to find out in a later incarnation. Oh, what do you know? I didn't expect that.
I'm not sure how to formulate this question, but in thinking about this idea of the non-place where we're all one, collective consciousness and that sort of thing, I believe in that. I occasionally catch glimpses of it. I definitely don't live there. But it seems to create a problem, particularly in the area of sexual relationships. And on one hand, I want to strive for that unity, but the more I capture that, the less it seems appropriate to have exclusive relationships. And that's a special thing to do, and even within me, it seems appropriate.
I hear where you're going. As you connect more deeply to the place inside yourself where you are in the place of consciousness or awareness or love or presence, and you rest in that, more and more you look at people and start to be in love with them all the time. And since most of us in this culture have arisen in our socialization process out of a conditional love environment, we have always, most of us have come away with a feeling of needing love, a feeling of deprivation. So we're working out of a deprivation model, so that when we feel that love, we want to collect it and possess it and hold it. And so we say, won't you come and, you know, nest with me? The predicament is that as you start to rest in that place of love, and it's not just turned on by some other being, which is in instinct theory called an innate releasing mechanism, that releases that thing in you, but you're starting to rest in it. As you rest in it, then everybody you start to be in love with. Then the question is, who do you sleep with and who do you don't? I mean, that's the question it's coming down to. And there's where the listening is very important, because you begin, I mean, I can be sexually turned on by almost anybody in the society at this point now. I mean, it all seems like a huge sexual dance to me. It's all a huge dance of love and intimacy and awakening and love. I don't sleep with everybody. And I listen to hear the appropriateness of what business I have with another human being. And sometimes, if you're attached to collecting, because you're still working out of the deprivation model, it gets complicated because the attachments of your mind say, ooh, there's more, I want that. Ooh, I want that. Ooh, I want that one too. But if there is not that attachment, because you've let go of the deprivation model, because you're starting to recognize your new state of being, that you are living in grace, or you are living as the beloved, or in the world of the beloved, then you start to quiet down after a little while, and you listen, and you hear the total social structure, the civilization, the possibilities, the cost, the energy, the efficiency, the human needs, the personality structure, and sometimes you can look at somebody and love them incredibly and be turned on by them, but there's nothing you have to do about it. And it's very weird at first. It's very weird because you are so turned on that you usually, if you were only a member of a species reproducing, that would suck you in at that point. But as you start to rest in consciousness and that quality of love, you, that's the resting in the divinity in you. That is not just your species identity. And then you don't have to act in a reactive, instinctive, compulsive way any longer, because that's only a part of you that acknowledges there is that desire and it could happen, but as you listen in the totality of all of it, it doesn't happen. Like at this moment, I could stand up and take all my clothes off and go to sleep. I could do it, but it doesn't feel right. I mean, it's, that's the level of it. It just isn't intuitively in the cards. It's not the way of things. I was giving a lecture once in Los Angeles, and I remember it was back in those days, and these people came up on stage as I rip off their clothes and said, okay, Ramda, Dick, this is the time. Take off your clothes. This is it. And I looked out at the audience, and I said, I don't think it's the time. I mean, it just doesn't feel appropriate at this moment. And they said, oh, you're all tight-assed, and it's your problem. You know, well, maybe, but it didn't feel intuitively right at that moment. And it's the same thing. You end up feeling appropriateness. And it isn't necessarily the appropriateness the culture says is appropriate. It's appropriate you feel the rightness of. I mean, I've had experiences where I'm helping somebody in the final moments of their life, and we are making love. And they die in the mode of us being in love with each other, in the deepest sense of kiss and hug and hold and tender touching. And I think, how am I going to put that in the journals? You know, how do you write that or write about that for the culture? Boy, oh boy. Ooh, what is he, some kind of necrophiliac? I mean, it's horrible. He makes love with dying people. But it intuitively feels right at that moment. I don't set it up as a rule. Well, now for dying 203, we will all make love. Because you don't do it that way. You've got to keep listening and listening and tuning and not being afraid to trust that intuitive sense. It may be very complicated politically and economically. I'm not saying there's a rule that you can hide behind. That's the thing. But you've got to examine how much your deprivation model about love and your unconscious identification with your instincts is ruling the roost and slowly bringing it up into awareness where you can hear it all, and out of that will come appropriate action. There's the lady behind you.
I have something about obstacles and non-resistance in the expression of our Dharma.
and kind of tying in with what he said earlier, when you find something that feels like a way or a path for you, and it seems you meet resistance or obstacles, your own experience about the meditation and the form of meditation you chose, when is that the same old thing about the inner listening, about when do I go past it, and when is it somebody saying turn right or turn left? I don't know if I'm making myself clear to you.
Try a little more on my mind.
Well, in the expression of our way,
yeah.
If we meet obstacles, if yeah. we meet resistance, I'm sometimes confused about whether the message is to
I
go
understand.
Through.
Okay, now I got it. Okay. And the answer is, there is no rule. Sometimes I meet a resistance, like I don't want to go to one of those meditation courses where I'm going to be beaten. But I want what I want the effect so much that I will go through that. I'm not a masochist, but I will go through that because I want it. And I will override my resistance joyfully. And there are other times where the resistance says, hey, not now, that's not the route. And I trust that. And I don't know why I do it. And more I'm trusting that intuitive, non-rational, where I'm not explaining to others why I do what I do. I read through letters. One, I pick up the phone and call, and another, I just leave, and it doesn't get answered for months. And I can't tell you why I do that. It's not they're the sickest or the this or the that. And sometimes when I examine it, it came out of my desire systems. And sometimes it came out of some higher thing where the person I call and they say, isn't it funny you just called now, I was about to commit suicide or whatever, you know. And I really have given up even thinking about why I do that. I think you can trust yourself more than most of us do. Most of us do.
What do you do with the thoughts, this is a big question, what do you do with the thoughts that invade your mind of a negative quality? I'm going on a trip, oh, that bus just went over the thing, maybe my vehicle will go over the thing. You're not worth anything, you're going to do this. The type of thing which you know is against your nature and your principles and all of that, it's, you could say it was kind of like the devil talking to you. But how do you keep these things out? How do you control them?
One of my teachers said to me, I'm talking now from a spiritual level, not a psychodynamic level. One of my teachers said to me, their old karma running off, don't make such a big deal. There's stuff coming out of the past, out of past births or the past of this birth. And when they come up, if they don't free you, let them go right away. The minute you notice them, okay, there's another one of those, bye. Hello, see you around. Don't feed them. The feed and caring of anger or judgment is an interesting thing, to learn how not to feed and cultivate anger and judgment. You know, because you're constantly judging, because you're feeling unworthy and inadequate, so you're constantly judging everybody as better or worse, or bigger or littler or something, more successful, less successful. And you see the judging mind keeps separating you from the universe, and it's not going to liberate you. And so finally, when you notice yourself, you just say, ah, there's judging, and then you just go back into the present. My guru once said to me, I mean, this was the way he taught me that. He said, Ram Dass, tell the truth. And he'd call me up from the back room, and they'd say, Ram Dass, Maharaji wants you. And I'd go running up, and I'd sit down, and I'd expect the greatest teachings in the world. He'd say, Ram Dass, yes, Maharaji, tell the truth. Yes, Maharaji, ja, go. So I'd go back, and a few minutes later, they'd say, Maharaji wants to see you. And I'd run up, and I'd sit down. Ram Dass, yes, tell the truth. Yes, Maharaji, ja. I mean, it's really like you think you're in a, you know. I mean, that's what a lot of it is, you know. It's not all, let me tell you, child, the greatest truth of the universe. It's all this kind of Mickey Mouse stuff going on. And so he's saying, tell the truth, tell the truth, tell the truth, until finally I think, okay, he wants me to tell the truth. I'm getting the message. So then he starts, once I start to feel the message, he starts the thing of Ram Dass, love everyone. So I get that about 40 times. So I start to realize that the truth is I don't love everyone. So which one am I going to do? And he's giving me conflicting messages. I decide that I've been trying to love everyone, but it's been a little hypocritical, and the truth is I don't, so why don't I try telling the truth for a while? The truth is, when I look at most of the people I'm around, I don't like them at all. So I started to just realize I didn't like everybody. I was with 35 people. They were with Westerners around Maharaji, and I really ended up, I detested all of them. For righteous reasons. I mean, really good reasons. Till finally I was so angry at everybody. It was bizarre. I mean, something happened that I just got more and more angry. It was over a period of 2 weeks. I don't know whether there was somebody's hand in it, but I mean, I was getting more angry. And I wasn't touching money in those days. I mean, it was phony. I was doing that too. I had a bag man that carried my money for me. But I was so mad at him and everybody that I had to walk. I wouldn't even allow them to carry my money. So I had to walk 8 miles to the temple every day. And they all got in the bus and rode there. And so when I got there, they were eating and they'd been with Maharaji and I was pissed off. And I came in and this guy brought some food to me that they'd been saving for me. And I picked it up and threw it in his face. I mean, I was really angry, as you can imagine. And Maharaji was sitting across the courtyard. Ram Dass. So I went over and he said, "Something troubling you?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "I hate all those people." I said, "I can't stand them. I can't stand their impurities. I can't stand my own impurities. In fact, I don't like anybody but you." He says, "You love me?" I said, "Yeah, I love you." And I started to sob. And he sent for milk, and he was pouring milk down me and hitting me on the head and pulling my beard. And after I quieted down, he leaned forward and he said, "I told you to love everyone." I said, "Yeah, but you told me to tell the truth, and the truth is that I don't love everyone." And he says, "Tell the truth and love everyone." Now, what do you do at that point, you see? I mean, what I saw was that when I finished being who I think I am, who is somebody who doesn't love everyone, and that's my truth, where's that from? He's telling me who I'll be when I get finished being who I think I am, right? And all I saw was he was saying, "Let it go, let it go." And so I went across and I cut an apple into many sections, or many apples, and I went around to each person and I fed them a piece of apple. But you know in Hinduism that if you feed somebody with anger in your heart, it's poison. And I didn't want to poison them, I just didn't like them. So I would hold the apple and I would work until I could let go of the anger. And I really, because I was right in every case, you understand. So it wasn't easy to let go of that anger. I mean, you know how hard it is when you're right. But I realized that he had said what to do when I wanted to get free. I didn't want to be... You have a choice if you want to be free or right. See? And I wanted to be free. And finally, I could put the apple... It took me about an hour and a half to put the apple into everybody's mouth. And he was watching the whole thing. And about 2 weeks later, he did some outrageous thing and I got angry at him. And I was sitting there steaming and he said... He opens his mouth, he says... "Got a piece of apple?" And we started a process where now I realize my anger isn't going to get me to God and I want to be free, so I just let go of my anger. Now, from a psychodynamic point of view, I don't work it through, I don't cathart it, I don't express it, I just let it go. And we all know psychologically that's a really bad thing to do, but that's what I do, and it's working. I am a much less angry human being than I was 5 years ago. Damn it. It's 11 o'clock. I think we should... yes, Ray.
Ramdas, it feels right the way you are with the dying, people in grief and pain. It feels right to care about everybody, and it feels right to care for everybody. I find myself in a dilemma. And sitting here listening to everyone talking, I was trying to think how I was going to formulate this without... I just don't know how to formulate the question, so I'm just going to put this out. Being in the fire department, I deal with stabbing, shootings, overdoses, violence all the time.
Yeah.
So I went through a period of going to meditation, sitting, enlightenment intensives, read books, pretend you're light. Look for the spirit up in the corner.
Yeah. All the ways.
All the different ways.
Okay.
And I just find myself in a situation of just being numb, becoming numb over a 12-year period of going to stabbing, shootings, heart attacks, people resisting dying. Most of the situations I come into, people are resisting. You know, they don't want to leave.
Yeah.
And they're holding on, they have their oxygen, they have their pills.
Yep.
Everything you could think of is around them.
Yep. Yep.
Ambulance comes in, where's the medications, who's the doctor, So it's, I've got into the pattern of turning on, shutting off, turning on, shutting off.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a little kid, I feel more, I feel more.
I understand.
Where it's a growing up, it's like, that's the way it is. If
that
someone's
is,
been stabbed,
I hear. But there are two ways, I hear your whole point, right? There are two ways of the statement, that's the way it is. One is, that's the way it is where you've turned off your heart in a sort of cynical way. Well, that's the way it is. And the other is where your heart's wide open, and that's the way it is. And you're right there with the person, allowing them to resist dying if that's what they need to do. But you are there with a peaceful presence that allows them to find peace through your being if they're ready to do that at that last moment. And that's what you can offer them. And it's just like Mother Teresa saying that the people in the gutter, the lepers that she's taking care of, are Christ in all his distressing disguises. Each one of those beings is an exercise for you in compassionate consciousness. You can do as much as you can handle. The way you handle it, because the choices aren't just coming into your human heart where it hurts like hell, or turning off. That's what usually the culture does. That's what I do a whole chapter about that about in here, about that professional warmth that people get into, where they turn it down because it's too painful to deal with all the pain, the suffering, and the resistance all the time. So you just sort of go numb as you're talking about it. The other way is to cultivate an awareness that allows you to be in a situation, your heart is open and it hurts, and at the same moment, there is equanimity that you've cultivated through all that stuff you've done that says, maybe it is right this person's going to die. I don't know. I will do what I can because I am an instrument of life to keep them alive. Whether they die is in the hands of God. It's not my hands. And I will be with them in such a way that if they are ready to let go, I'll be there for them. And if they're not, they're not. And so you're using it as an exercise to cultivate your higher consciousness through the process of doing it each time. And every time you get to it, the reason you close your heart is because you see that the option to it is the pain of the human heart. And what we're trying to do is cultivate the balance between the human heart, which hurts like hell with others suffering, and the expression, my heart goes out to you. And we're overwhelmed because my heart's going out here, and then there's suffering here, and my heart goes out here, and there's suffering here, and my heart goes out there, and pretty soon you can't stand it anymore, especially if you're in a business like yours, where there's just so much suffering you're facing all the time. But as you cultivate that higher awareness that looks at things and says, things, there is law, there is meaning to suffering, death occurs when it is supposed to, it is just happening as it needs to, some people will suffer, that's their process, and part of the perfection is me being an instrument to help end the suffering if I can. You see all that the way it is. If you just stay up there, as I talk about in my lectures, and somebody falls down in front of you, you say, karma. Which is a very cold thing, because that's a very impersonal, cold place. If you're just down in your human heart, you can't bear it, so you turn off, and you become cynical or numb or whatever you become. The game is to balance that higher wisdom with the open human heart. There's a beautiful statue of the Buddha that has a little smile at the end, at the edge, and it's known as the smile of unbearable compassion. You're looking out at how it all is. Your heart is wide open. It's ripped you to shreds so much already. I mean, if you think a child dying is hard, that you realize that for a saint, everybody is their child. So they're all the people in the world, the billions of the world, and how many are dying every second. They're all, just because you're not seeing them doesn't mean they're not suffering and dying. And your heart is just so open, it's just open. But with it all is this absolute equanimity of it is, it is, it is. And that, oh, quality. That what's called a living dead. It's the, oh. and the heart's open and the and you put those two together, there's compassion. There's compassion. So you keep cultivating. Sometimes you get so high, but your heart closes. Sometimes your heart gets so open, but you forget your higher wisdom. You keep cultivating until you get that balance just right, just right. That's a good way to end. But I think it would be nice for us maybe just to... We've been talking about listen. And there's a nice song that you probably know called Listen, Listen, Listen. Just very gently and quietly, let's just play with it. It's listen, listen, listen. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. I will never forget you. I will never forsake. Now, wait a second. The you is many levels of you. The you can be, I won't forget you, or I won't forget the highest being that's within me. You meaning our highest self, or the spirit, or God. It's a way of remembering. And you can play with it, all the different ways of I will never forget you. Or maybe the singer is the higher part of you that's not forgetting the part of you that's caught. Okay, it goes the other way. Just play with it. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you, I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Never forget you, I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you, I will never forsake you, I will never forget you, I will never forsake you. Silence, we know. It's been a beautiful evening. Thank you so much. Namaste. Namaste.